From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, reaction to President Trump's tweets and top Democrats' decision to pull out of a meeting with Trump.
I would hope that given the debate over taxes, you would actually have people in an adult moment saying that we're not going to do any tweeting. We're simply going to sit down and discuss some of these problems.
Plus, Governor Baker officially kicks off his reelection campaign.
We've built strong communities across Massachusetts, but there's a ton more left to do.
And like any good New Englander, Will Dowd spent an entire year thinking about nothing but the weather.
Once you really tune yourself into the weather and to, you know, the way the shadows are cast and the way the sunlight feels and acts, it's like you're a little bit tuned into a different way of measuring the world.
The poetic beauty of New England weather coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The idea was that top congressional Democrats would meet with President Trump and top Republicans today because, after all, they've all got to work together to avoid a potential government shutdown that could be just 10 days away. That was the idea. But then President Trump tweeted. He wrote, quote, "Meeting with Chuck and Nancy today about keeping government open and working. Problem is, they want illegal immigrants flooding into our country, are weak on crime, and want to substantially raise taxes. I don't see a deal," end quote. So, Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer and Representative Nancy Pelosi said, fine, no meeting. Here's Schumer a little while ago on the Senate floor.
The president said, I don't see a deal, 3 hours before our meeting, before he heard anything we had to say. Given that the president doesn't see a deal between Democrats and the White House, Leader Pelosi and I believe the best path forward is to continue negotiating with our Republican counterparts in Congress instead.
Over at the White House, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders told Democrats to, quote, stop the political grandstanding. But with this morning's tweet, it's the president who dangled the possibility of a government shutdown, something he's explicitly threatened twice before this year. So let's get the view of a member of the Massachusetts delegation. We spoke a little bit earlier with Congressman Richard Neal. I asked him what he thought of the Democrats' decision to pull out of today's meeting with the president.
Well, I don't understand in this atmosphere, and it's completely foreign to me, how the president believes that you can insult your way to cooperation.
Right.
And I think trying to find common purpose and being invited to the White House really ought to engage sort of a pretty sophisticated and important conversation, given the problems that the nation faces.
But on the other hand, wouldn't it be advantageous to Democrats to rise above that and go ahead and meet anyway, because he still is the president of the United States?
I think the difficulty with that is, and you run the risk of being insulted after the meeting is over, not based upon the substance of the meeting, as opposed to the conflict that was built into the meeting from the beginning by the use of technology.
I feel like we're in an age now that, regardless of party, given the president's use of Twitter, that's just going to happen no matter what. What can Democrats do to deal with the president or to work with him, knowing that no matter what they do, or even for some Republicans, no matter what they do, there's going to be some kind of response on Twitter from the president of the United States?
Well, I think that this conflict has been simmering for a long period of time, and I think that part of the difficulty is it's the development of what I would refer to as instant opinion. The problem with instant opinion is that frequently you don't draw the right conclusions based on additional evidence. And I would hope that given the debate over taxes, the debate over health care, the debate over what to do about North Korea, that you would actually have people in an adult moment saying that we're not going to do any tweeting. We're simply going to sit down and discuss some of these problems. I think that would be advantageous to the American family.
You know, I'm just looking once again at the president's tweet from several hours ago, and the full text of it is, meeting with Chuck and Nancy today, and he put those in quotes, about keeping government open and working. Problem is, they want illegal immigrants flooding into our country unchecked and are weak on crime and want to substantially raise taxes. I don't see a deal. That was what the president wrote on Twitter. I mean, let's just talk about the substance of his accusations about Democrats. What do you make of him saying that Democrats want to raise taxes, showing opposition to the Republican tax plan?
Well, if you I think, follow the president's tweeting to its manifest moment. And what you're essentially having him say is that he's already made a decision before the negotiations can commence. Now, that's entirely different than what he said just a few months ago when he indicated that there was a path to perhaps finding agreement on the DACA situation and the tax issues. And there are still a number of Medicare extenders that have to be done, and also renewing the Children's Health Insurance Program is important as well. So I don't understand how the use of insult and invective can be helpful to trying to resolve some of these issues as we now come down the home stretch of the legislative calendar.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know that the Senate will eventually vote on its version of changes to the tax code, but I want to talk with you for a second about the one that did pass through the House. I mean, you voted against it, right?
I did.
Yeah. So talk to me about the parts of it that led you to not support it, because, you know, a major thrust of the tax plan is the idea that taxes would get cut for many Americans.
Well, I also think that the key to the discussion over taxes is really a review of distributional tables to have a better understanding of who gets what. And once the budget ceiling was built at $1.5 trillion, which actually, when you consider that that's money that's going to be borrowed over 10 years, the borrowing comes closer to $2.3 trillion, that the problem is that what we were being asked to give up to secure tax relief for people really at the very top. I don't understand, for example, why there is this necessity to repeal the estate tax. I don't know why there's this necessity to repeal the alternative minimum tax. And the Congressional Budget Office, as recently as this morning, has indicated that by, I believe, 2025, people who earn under $75,000 a year, they're going to be asked to pay for this. I mean, trying to shoehorn these budget numbers into our tax system is the challenge. And I think that, again, there was an opportunity here for both parties in a bipartisan manner, referenced upon what had happened in 1986, where there were committee hearings, 450 witnesses offered testimony, and both parties found accommodation is the path that we should have followed here. And unfortunately, that's not going to be the case.
Yeah. Now, what about the alternative minimum tax? Because I know a couple of years ago, you were part of an effort to eliminate the AMT for middle-class families.
Right. And I've been successful on that front. Yeah. And 27 million Americans, middle-class Americans, no longer pay alternative minimum tax. And I'd like to take full responsibility for that, to be candid with you, because over the course of three presidential administrations, I offered the crusade against middle-class people paying alternative minimum tax. Now you're down to 4.5 million families being asked to pay alternative minimum tax, who in fact are really the upper crust in America. And I think that putting the spotlight on that is very important.
Yeah. Now, just if I could ask you, I don't know if you have any thoughts on the Senate's version of a tax plan.
Oh, I sure do.
Okay, so tell me about it. Because what about the provision in there to repeal the Affordable Care Act's individual insurance mandate?
Well, I think that that's very poor policy in terms of choice. I think that this should be done with full legislative discussion. Recall that in the Senate there were no hearings as well. You're now looking at the end of New Markets tax credits, the historic tax credit. You're going to be boosting taxes on people who take advantage of the health care deduction once you've expended 10% of your income. And again, you're targeting people in an effort to cut the tax rate for people at the very top. And I think that that's where the miscalculation is coming in. And right now, of interest, this is when you're seeing the patchwork work being undertaken. This is when there's an effort made in the Senate to accommodate every conceivable effort to get to 52. So you're seeing drilling in the ANWR being added. You're seeing the mandate being added. And now you're going to see perhaps see a proposal that will change how pass-through entities are taxed. This is all in an effort to get to 52. And it will not be pleasant to watch.
I mean, I don't know. Are you hearing from your Senate colleagues? Do you think they can get there?
Well, I think there's about six individuals who have either stated some agnosticism on tax reform or said that they can't support it in its current form. So I think that there are six what we would call the Democratic side gets for that purpose. And I'm hopeful that if this were to go down, then they would come back to us and say, look, let's do this in a manner that's similar to what took place back in 1986. And I want to tell you, in all sincerity, I'm in for negotiation.
Okay. Okay. Well, if we can just pivot slightly for a moment, Congressman, I just want to ask you about, you know, another major issue going on Capitol Hill, that Representative John Conyers is stepping aside as ranking member of the Judiciary Committee because of sexual harassment allegations. And, of course, Senator Al Franken also facing severe sexual harassment allegations. I mean, do you think that there's kind of a crisis on this brewing on Capitol Hill, and what can people do?
Well, I don't know that there's a crisis, but I do think that in both instances, this should be handled by the Ethics Committee, and I think a careful examination by the Ethics Committee would perhaps shed some light on the need to change the law that was passed in 1995. So we would have a better understanding as to the proportion of individuals that might or might not be involved in this. One of the challenges here really is that there is such a thing as due process. And the secondary issue that I think we need to be mindful of is, how do you undo perhaps agreements that have been made with a guarantee of certain privacies? So I think those are legal questions, but as much as we would all like to, I think, have more light to be shown on what happened, you do run into some legal technicalities. So I'm okay with these two cases being referred to ethics.
Really? Okay, because, I mean, I take your point about legal technicalities and due process, but Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi a couple of days ago said that, you know, part of what needs to happen is that John Conyers needs to do the right thing, and there was some pushback to that because it's not really up to him, right? It's up to the Ethics Committee. I just wonder if this is a moment where Democrats could show some more spine on this issue.
Yeah, and I agree, but I think that you perhaps are, not you, but I think perhaps we're having an argument about 1995 in the year 2000. 17, and things have certainly changed pretty radically given the press postings that have, I think, described some pretty bad behavior. So I think that there's an opportunity here to go forward on it. And recall that in the Conyers case in particular, that would be up to the Democratic caucus to decide whether or not he would stay in his position. And I think he wisely decided that he knew what was going to happen, and the outcome was for him to step aside while the Ethics Committee undertakes its work.
Mm. Finally, just to kind of broad-based question, Congressman, because I'm really curious about what every member of the delegation thinks about this. I mean, what is the mood like on Capitol Hill these days? I mean, from here at home, we sort of look over in Washington and see this giant hornet's nest of dysfunction. Is that fair?
I think that certainly the intense polarization has not been helpful, and I think that the well-organized efforts on the left and the right, they have known where just to put the needle in. And I also think that the news media undertakes now what I would consider to be 24 hours of speculation and analysis. And I also think that part of the challenge is that this has really gone on for a long period of time. This isn't something that just happened. I mean, you can go back to the Jim Wright investigation, the Newt Gingrich investigation. You can go to the Tower nomination. You can go to the Thomas nomination. You can go to the Clinton impeachment. You could go to Bush v. Gore. And this has really gone on for a long period of time, and I wish that we would be able to return to the days in which I joined the Congress back in 1988, when you really had civilized conversations and people tried to find common purpose. But the polarization that you currently witness in Congress is not healthy for a representative democracy.
You say you wish. Does that mean that you don't think it's actually possible?
I think Tip O'Neill used to have a great comment when he used to suggest that the people that were in the well of the House yelling every day, they were generally the ones who had political problems back home. And I think that the fact that language is more acerbic and incendiary, only to be desirous of drawing the quote, has also not been helpful.
Well, Congressman Richard Neal, really appreciate this conversation today. All right, take care.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Well, we spoke with Congressman Neal earlier today. Now, in just the past half hour, news on that Senate tax bill. The Senate Budget Committee voted 12-11, a party line vote, to send the Republican Senate tax bill to the full floor. They just took that vote this afternoon, and a full Senate vote could take place as early as Thursday. But is every Republican senator on board? Well, just a little while ago, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he's working on it.
It's a challenging exercise. Think of sitting there with a Rubik's Cube trying to get to 50.
All right, let's go to Matt Visor. He's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Matt, it's good to talk to you again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so let's talk about that Senate Budget Committee vote, because two Republican holdouts on the bill, Bob Corker and Ron Johnson, have they dropped their objections because they both voted to advance the bill to the full floor?
they did. And they're not fully dropping their objections. They're using language that President Trump, we're told, was used in this meeting with Republicans today, which is, let's keep the process going. So they did drop at least some of their objections to fixing the legislative text that they wanted to be fixed in committee, and they're moving it to the Senate floor. Ron Johnson, Bob Corker, two of those who were holding out, could still vote against it on the Senate floor, but they are saying with their votes today that we want this process to move forward.
Okay. I'm seeing here, actually, the Washington Post is quoting Bob Corker as saying, "I was able to work out something that is fairly satisfying to me just a few minutes ago, and I plan to vote yes." I think that was on the Budget Committee vote that just took place. What about Susan Collins? Because, again, there's just a handful of senators here who haven't fully committed, GOP senators who haven't committed to the tax bill, and McConnell can only afford to lose one or two of them. But I'm seeing that Susan Collins is saying that today, after meeting with the president, that a lot of her concerns are being addressed.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly some momentum for the tax bill right now after this meeting. Heading into this Budget Committee vote, there was some speculation that it could meet a roadblock, and it didn't. It cleared the roadblocks, at least for now. And you know, the senators are increasingly using language that suggests that they're open to voting for this package. One of the things to watch for is Susan Collins, and again, she's suggesting that she's open to voting for this, but the individual mandate and whether that provision stays in and what that looks like in the final text is something that Susan Collins has expressed some concern with. Sort of how those concerns are being addressed, we don't quite know yet.
Yeah, I'm wondering, have we heard anything from the likes of John McCain or Lisa Murkowski on this yet? Because, of course, they were two of the key votes that no votes that ended up killing the GOP's effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act. So have we heard anything from them yet about the tax bill?
They are also expressing a little bit of, you know, holding out. You know, they're not sort of fully committing either way. The individual mandate is a little bit different politically for some of those senators than the full-scale repeal of the health care bill. You're seeing Susan Collins, for example, start to talk about how she views it as, you know, more appropriate at not requiring people to buy health care insurance, you know, as opposed to her opposition to repealing the entire Affordable Care Act as the previous health care bill would do. So they're moving more in that direction of trying to justify publicly why they would be okay with getting rid of the individual mandate.
Mm. Now, in my conversation with Congressman Neal a couple of minutes ago, he had mentioned some numbers from the Congressional Budget Office. Just to recap those, the CBO said that it believes that that the Senate tax bill could hurt workers earning less than $30,000 a year, and then that by 2027, the CBO says Americans earning $75,000 a year or less as a group would actually see their taxes increase because the individual tax cuts would expire near the end of 2025. It doesn't seem like any of those numbers are making a big difference in terms of yes and no votes amongst the GOP, Matt.
Not among Republicans, but it's certainly giving Democrats some political ammunition as they argue against this tax bill. And should it pass, going into the midterms, trying to make that case ever more strenuously to voters. So I think that could come in this next phase, and you're hearing a lot of that. And these statistics and the attempts to analyze exactly what this tax bill would do to an average taxpayer, a middle-class taxpayer, you know, certainly those messages are getting out there. But so far, there's been a lot of moving pieces to what this legislation is. And we should also point out that whatever the Senate passes is likely to be quite different from what the House passed. And there will have to reconcile those differences before this can go to President Trump's desk
right.
for any signature. So I think that you're starting to get some of those conversations and full analysis of what this means.
Yeah.
But in general, corporations seem to do a lot better under a lot of these analyses compared to middle class taxpayers.
Right. Well, Matt Visor, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Governor Charlie Baker's made it official. He's seeking re-election. He spoke about his bid following a tour of table talk pies in Worcester.
Our focus on creating a great commonwealth from one end to the other, we've made tremendous progress on that. A lot of job growth and a lot of success. We've built strong communities across Massachusetts, but there's a ton more left to do.
Okay, let's be honest. Baker's re-election announcement is basically a surprise to nobody. He's a very popular governor, even though he faces challenges from three Democrats so far. Former Finance Secretary Jay Gonzalez, environmental activist Bob Massey, and Newton Mayor Seti Warren. And yes, there's still 11 months to go before the 2018 election. But let's take a look at the race anyway, as it's shaping up now and challenges ahead for Charlie Baker's attempt at re-election. We're joined now by WBUR Steve Brown. He's our man at the State House. Hi there, Steve.
Hi there, Meghna.
Hey, so I should note that your office is what, just right above the governor's office in the State House?
Right up the stairs. I'm about a 10-second walk from the governor's office.
So you have been watching his term incredibly closely so far.
I have, yes.
Yeah. And so what did he say today about why he wants to run?
Well, you know, it's a good gig. He didn't say that, but it is a good gig. He genuinely appears to like the job. He's having fun down there. He seems to revel in the wonky details of the job. And by seeking re-election, he's also seeking validation on what he's done so far. Think of Sally Field. They like me. They really like me. That's motivating stuff for pretty much every politician, some more than others. And I'm sure this plays into to Baker's thinking. In announcing his reasons for running today, he cited his accomplishments regarding the economy, public transportation, housing. But as we heard in that tape just a minute ago, he followed that up by saying there's a ton left more to do.
Right.
In areas of job creation, he wants more housing, he wants to close the education achievement gap, he wants to make the T more reliable, and wants to make greater strides in the battle against opioid addiction. So as far as he can tell, his job's not done yet.
Yeah, and as we noted, he's an incredibly popular governor. I think one of the most, if not the most popular governor in the entire country right now. A WBUR poll a couple of weeks ago showed the governor with a very wide lead over his three Democratic challengers. And, you know, I can imagine people saying a poll 11 months prior to an election, what does it mean? It may not mean anything. But I think it tells us about the certain kinds of challenges that the Democrats have facing someone like Charlie Baker. I mean, what are their challenges?
These numbers are huge. The challenges for Jay Gonzalez, Seti Warren, and Bob Massey, first of all, is just to get people to know who they are. The polls are showing that a lot of people have never heard of these three guys. That's a big challenge when you're trying to go up against Charlie Baker in 11 months. That WBUR poll showed, again, this was just from a couple of weeks ago, Baker beat Seti Warren 58% to 24%. Baker beats Jay Gonzalez 59% to 19%. Baker beats Bob Massey 60% to 21%. Now, as they get a little more well-known, I think some of those numbers might go up, but not by much.
Yeah. You know, that poll also showed us that not only is the governor viewed favorably by 70% of Massachusetts Republicans, but 67% of unenrolled voters and 66% of Democrats. So he's pretty popular across the board.
Yeah, you know, the largest voting bloc are unenrolled, folks that are neither in the Democratic nor Republican Party, although they probably lean one way or the other. They just don't want to be associated with an organized party. But, you know, he's very popular among the unenrolled, and that will be his ace in the hole come next November.
Mm. Now, what about money? He's got a huge war chest in comparison to his Democratic challengers.
A ton of money. Charlie Baker and his lieutenant governor, Karen Polito, combined at this point have just about $10 million combined in the bank. That is mind-blowing. They've indicated also they'd like to raise $30 million for this race. Now, those Democrats we were talking about, to help them boost their name recognition, I'll mention their names again, Seti Warren, Jay Gonzalez, and Bob Massey, all combined right now, they have $100,000 in the bank. And they have to use that money to beat up each other in the primary coming up. The winner will get more dough, I'm sure, but it's probably not going to be close to that $30 million range.
Okay, so they have $100,000 right now in comparison to the almost $10 million that Baker and Polito have?
Combined,
wow.
Yes.
Okay, so that's two orders of magnitude. All right. Now, okay, let's get some historical context here, though. I mean, we're talking about Baker's popularity and his war chest, but, I mean, how unusual is this kind of imbalance at this point in a gubernatorial race, Steve?
It's very unusual. I look back to what the numbers were in November of 2009. Now, that was 11 months out before the 2010 gubernatorial election. Deval Patrick was running for re-election against a guy named Charlie Baker, by the way. at that point, at the same time, Deval Patrick had $693,000 in the bank. Charlie Baker had, I believe, a little over $1 million at that time. Deval Patrick walked away from 2010 with a narrow win. Now, had Baker been able to raise more money back then, he might have been able to knock Deval Patrick off, thanks in part to that Tea Party wave that was going on back in 2010, if you remember that. Now, I'm sure Charlie Baker has that in mind because, you know, there could be a wave going the other way, that national wave against Republicans. So Charlie Baker's determined to have buckets full of cash to fend off any anti-Republican tide that might splash over the borders into Massachusetts.
I see. So that other way you're talking about is in 2018, Senator Elizabeth Warren is going to face re-election as well, and that could galvanize Democrats in the state.
That's right. You know, ultimately, you know, everybody, a lot of the political observers are saying Charlie Baker is going to win the race and that Elizabeth Warren is going to win the race. And so that's going to mean there's going to be a block of voters that vote for Elizabeth Warren and Charlie Baker.
Well, that's WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown bringing us up to speed on Governor Charlie Baker's announcement today that he is indeed going to seek re-election. Steve, thanks so very much.
Thanks, Magna. Come up, see the office sometime.
Will do. Well, under Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, the city of Boston has set the ambitious goal of becoming carbon neutral by 2050. Today, the city launched its Carbon Free Boston initiative with the goal of helping the city balance its climate goals with booming development. WBUR's Bruce Gellerman reports on the challenge of fueling the city's future.
Here's a familiar construction cacophony heard on Boston streets these days. Today, there are 106 buildings worth $9 billion under construction in Boston. Over the past 5 years, the city has approved adding the square footage equal to 45 new Prudential Towers. Austin Blackman is Boston's chief of energy, environment, and open space.
We're very fortunate right now. Boston is in one of its largest building booms in its history, and that means that there are great opportunities for us to have a lasting impact on the future of our city.
Boston already has more LEED-certified energy-efficient buildings than any other city in the nation. And Massachusetts is the most energy-efficient state in the country, 7 years in a row. By 2050, the state is committed to reducing climate-changing emissions from fossil fuels by 80%. Boston is even more ambitious. It wants to be carbon neutral by then. But what it doesn't have is a detailed plan to get there. Boston's climate and energy czar, Austin Blackman.
We need to understand what policies and actions are going to be most cost-efficient and most effective to help us accomplish that carbon-neutral goal.
So Boston is assembling a new team to investigate the alternatives. Energy experts from the city, outside consultants, and Boston University will plot a variety of paths the city can take to become carbon-neutral by 2050. They'll focus on four sectors to curb climate emissions: transportation, waste, electricity, and heat. Heat is the largest and toughest place to cut greenhouse gas emissions. 50% of energy used to heat homes and companies in Massachusetts comes from burning natural gas. and Boston's building boom has fueled the need for more.
Gas demand continues to be strong in Massachusetts.
John Stavrakis is Vice President of Gas Asset Management at National Grid. He oversees the utility's network of gas pipelines in the state. Stavrakis looks out 5 and 10 years to plan for the supply and demand for natural gas.
People want gas. We connect 10 to 11,000 new customers a year. There's been tremendous growth in the seaport, so there is a need for additional gas supply to serve that customer base.
Using natural gas instead of coal to generate electricity has dramatically reduced climate change emissions in Massachusetts, and demand for electricity is declining. Suppliers of gas say it can be a bridge to the future for heating too, reducing greenhouse gases until alternatives are found. But critics say more gas is a bridge too far.
I'm trying to stop the building of new fossil fuel infrastructure in the city of Boston.
Ania Camargo is with Mothers Out Front. It's a group trying to get leaky gas pipes plugged in the city. She's also a member of the Boston Clean Energy Coalition, which wants to stop new gas mains from being laid under city streets.
We can't be carbon neutral by 2050 if we continue to build with natural gas. I mean, the only way we can get there is if we transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy.
I think what we need to do, we need to introduce a disruptive mindset on climate change.
A call for radical change in constructing new buildings from perhaps a surprising voice. John Fish is president and CEO of Suffolk. The Boston-based firm is the biggest builder in New England and one of the largest in the nation. He says new sustainable construction methods and materials will help reduce the demand for fossil fuels.
And there's no doubt with all of the innovation and technology that's going on, we can do a much better job than we're doing right now.
But Fish says the marketplace, developers and buyers, need to be educated and make the big changes needed to reduce emissions. Less than 10% of the lifetime costs of a building are in constructing it. The rest is maintenance and utilities. Fish says you pay now or you pay more later.
The long-term cost, I would argue, to build more sustainable technologies in buildings is much more competitive than it is constructing buildings the way they're building them today.
As Boston's skyline rises, John Fish, whose company Suffolk Construction is responsible for much of it, says the choices we make over the next few years about how to heat new buildings and retrofit old ones will have profound effects.
We have to make this investment now if we're going to be able to preserve ourselves for the future. If we don't, the price will be tenfold what it could be today. We need to come together as a thoughtful community to listen. Not what can we do, but what are we going to do?
Boston's new panel that will consider how the city will fuel its future is expected to release its report next summer.
That's WBUR's Bruce Gellerman. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. John Hammond is 98 years old today. He lives in Wilbraham. But 75 years ago today, he was just 23, a young man who'd taken his girlfriend for a night out at what was then one of Boston's fanciest nightclubs, the Coconut Grove. On November 28, 1942, Hammond was just a couple of days away from joining the military. But that night, the club went up in flames.
I saw the kid light a match or whatever, which hit the ceiling, and the ceiling covered with cloth, and a pile of people going up the stairs. When they got to the top of the stairs, nobody could go out the revolving door because they were plugged with people.
The Coconut Grove fire was one of the deadliest in U.S. history. 492 people were killed, 166 injured. Hammond was one of the lucky ones who got out.
I had a table in the back, and I knew there was a giant door there. So I fought our way to that spot, but the door was locked, and I figured this is the end of the line. So just about the time I was ready to pass out, the fireman broke that door down, and I got out. And was able to walk to the road, and we went to the hospital.
John Haymond was severely burned, and he never got to start his military service, but he did survive, unlike his girlfriend, who died at the hospital. Now, official reports from the time say there's no definitive cause for the fire, but you heard Haymond talk about seeing a young busboy lighting a match in order to see better as he was trying to change a light bulb. That story matches memories from other survivors, as was revealed in 2012, when transcripts of police interviews with Coconut Grove survivors were made public. Back then, we spoke with reporter Stephanie Shiro, the author of the 2005 book, The Coconut Grove Fire, about what we learned from those police transcripts and what mysteries still remain about the fire.
I think that what they give is an immediate account of what happened that night. These are done mostly the next day, and they're very raw, and they're done by people who have the memories very, very much alive. Memories play tricks on us, and police officers will say there's no witness worse than an eyewitness. And in examining many of the various accounts of the fire, you'll find so many contradictions. This will sort of add to those contradictions, but it will also add to our understanding. I mean, these are people who escaped. I mean, some of them are people who are still looking for loved ones, who don't even know what happened to some of their companions that went into the fire with them.
All this time later.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, one of the things that really caught our attention was that we also have in these interviews the immediate reaction from one Stanley Tomaszewski. Now, remind us who he is and why he's important.
Stanley Tomaszewski was a 16-year-old busboy who was working the night of the fire. And he is largely faulted for lighting a match to screw in a light bulb that had come loose, and that particular flame was supposedly caught a palm tree in the downstairs lounge of the Coconut Grove, and that's where the fire started. Now, there are many people who dispute that theory, and there's a lot of theories of why this fire was so hot, spread so fast, and why it went out so quickly, which is another mystery. Stanley lived a life under the shadow of the Coconut Grove for the rest of his life, even though he went on to be in the Army and lived a very honorable life. He would get phone calls in the middle of the night blaming him for this fire. And in these interviews, this shows how it came to pass that he first described lighting that match. There's a bit of a mythology that he was very forthright about it. If you read these transcripts, you'll see the police or the questioners had to kind of tease it out of him.
Well, they ask him, what, five times if he had lit a match? And he says no,
exactly.
Until he finally says, yes, I did.
And finally he admits it. Now, you've got to understand, this is a 16-year-old boy. He was the main support of his parents, and he was absolutely traumatized. The first question the police put to him is, are you Polish, you'll notice. Mm-hmm. In other words, they hear his accent, and they immediately want to determine his ethnic status, because this is the war, and there were some concerns about spies, about, you know, who are these people. So I think the transcripts really offer a kind of a telescope into the Coconut Grove, but also to the kind of tenor of the times.
The police procedure around World War II in Boston,
exactly.
1942.
Exactly.
Well, Stanley Tomaszewski, in the transcripts, there's a portion where he says, I couldn't see the bulb that he was trying to change, and I struck a match and put it on, and then I stepped away. Then all of a sudden, the palm tree seemed to take fire. I was standing on top of the bench when I saw the fire. Some lady said, look, the palm tree on fire. I tried to beat it out with my hands. And then later on in these police transcripts, for example, a woman named Joyce Spector says she was in the building and she felt those flames licking at me, at her, and she crawled under the tables on her hands and knees. And then she says, all I can remember is people stepping on me, on my head and back, and I came to some sort of smoke-filled place. There was a million bodies and someone pulled me out by the head. I mean, you can feel you can still feel the shock in these transcripts that they're feeling in the moments when they're describing it to the police.
And it's very raw, but it's very realistic. And the thing is that these are, looking at these today, crowdsourcing them, having people who've heard stories from their parents and grandparents about the fire, experts, now that these are available, people can look at this and maybe we can get some insights into what actually caused the fire? Was it indeed this match, which is the obvious answer? But in so many ways, there are so many mysteries about the fire. I think you'll find in these transcripts people describing how fast it is, how they're mm-hmm. literally running out and the flames are right behind them. So it is a very stark, but it's also very necessary. I mean, we are still finding out things about this fire. I can't emphasize that enough. Every time I do a lecture, I find people with new stories.
That was Stephanie Shuro, author of the book The Coconut Grove Fire. We spoke with her back in 2012. Today marks the 75th anniversary of that deadly inferno. Well, finally today, like any good New Englander, Will Dowd spent an entire year thinking about nothing but the weather. And in the spirit of Henry David Thoreau's Walden, Dowd kept a journal of his observations and the poetic beauty of what he saw across Massachusetts landscape. The result of his year-long introspection is his debut collection of essays titled Areas of Fog. And Will Dowd joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me, Magna.
I'm going to have you read a little bit from Areas of Fog in just a moment. But first, I actually want to ask you a basic question.
Sure.
Why keep track of your thoughts about the weather for an entire year?
Right. Who would do such a thing? I did it because I was struck with writer's block. I had tons of creative energy, but I didn't have a subject. And I was just stalled for a really long time. And so what I did is one day I had this idea that I would resort to our regional habit that we have of when you have nothing to talk about, talking about the weather.
Or complaining about the weather.
Mostly complaining. And so I used the weather as an opening to a series of essays which I kept every week for an entire year.
Well, I would love if you could read a little bit of the fruits of all that labor. And just how about this part right here from your overture?
Sure. This is I wrote this on January 1st. So it was New Year's Day. And this is how it opens. All the weathermen of New England go mad eventually. After a few decades spent attempting to predict the unpredictable, they succumb to a kind of meteorological nihilism and wander out of the studio mid-broadcast, muttering to themselves, and can be seen a week later selling wilted roses on the side of the highway. It's not the seasonal anarchy, all those balmy Christmases and washed-out Junes, but rather the perverse changeability of our daily weather, the adolescent moodiness of our sun and sky, that finally unravels the sweater of their sanity. In the spring, I have counted 136 different kinds of weather inside of 4 and 20 hours, Mark Twain, a Hartford resident for 17 years, once quipped. Yet while they may be doomed to fail, we don't mock our weathermen, even though we see them for what they are, oracles draped in sheep entrails. We don't change the channel. We listen politely to their forecast, and then we talk about it.
That's Will Dowd reading an excerpt of his collection of essays called Areas of Fog. Yeah, we talk about it a lot.
We do. You know, when I started this, it was a conceit. But actually, as I went along, I discovered that I think all our talk about the weather actually has a deeper meaning. I think it's a great uniter. It doesn't matter who you are, whether you're rich or poor or old or young. If you're walking through slush, your socks are getting wet.
Yeah. I mean, weather is a great uniter. It's a great equalizer, especially in a place like New England, whose weather is so mercurial. So let me ask you, I mean, New England still has a huge variety of weather on any particular day in any part of the region. Where in New England were you?
Yes. So I grew up on the South Shore. I moved away for a while and then moved back. Perhaps that was contributing to my writer's block, being back in my hometown. We all know what that experience is like. And I'd grown up in New England, taking our fickle weather for granted. And then once I was separated from it and came back, I realized just how sort of strange it is that all the climates of the world seem to come to us and converge on our little corner.
Yeah, I mean, so just for example, I was thinking of on a day that you could be basking under the sun on the South Shore, if you were at the top of Mount Washington in New Hampshire, you could be getting your face blown off by the wind practically.
Absolutely.
But I'd like to just read a little bit from one of your January entry that you made,
sure,
because I think this will really, really hit home for so many people listening. You write that it's the existential question that all New Englanders ask themselves in late January. We stand at or lie beneath a sunny window, attempting to bask in secondhand warm, and we ask ourselves the question, why is winter happening to me? Why do I live here voluntarily? I feel like we've come through a couple winters like that where that is exactly what everyone was thinking.
Yes, exactly. I mean, famously, J.D. Salinger said, poets take the weather so personally. I think we're all poets in New England. We really treat it as if it's a sentient being, as if it has it's a sort of judgment on us. And I think that does come from our history, our literary history, and even the Puritan history that we have in this region, because they really saw the weather as God's hand. And God, you know, blessing or passing judgment on us. And I think we still subconsciously feel that every time, you know, a bride prays for clear skies on her the day of her outdoor wedding, you know, I think we're tapping into that.
You have in a February entry, it's as if certain features of New England weather are copyrighted by certain writers. Dickinson has a trademark on that slant of afternoon light. Frost owns ice-bowed bows.
Try saying that 20 times fast.
Or even once.
Yes.
And Nabokov has an incontestable claim on melting icicles. Such a good point. Were there other artists, writers, or I'll throw it even further open, painters that inspired you?
Absolutely. So every essay pretty much brings in a historical figure. Andrew Wyeth makes an appearance pretty early because I say when it snows outside, every window becomes the frame to an Andrew Wyeth painting in New England. And that's what inhabits my brain because I was a huge reader, a huge consumer of art. I love this stuff. And I think that weather in particular for New England writers and artists has just been such a great resource for metaphor and material because it's something we all have access to and it's a kind of common language where we can use to ask big questions.
Yeah. You know, you're so right. Once you sort of open your mind to the primacy of weather in New England art and literature, it's hard to stop thinking about it because I was thinking all of a sudden a horse shaking its snowy mane in a Frost poem.
Right.
Or the late summer sun of a Hopper painting from the Cape.
Like, absolutely.
It just fills your mind. Well, when you get to summer in the essays, you write, all winter you looked forward to summer. You anticipated the return of the sun with religious fervor, convinced that ecstasy and sunlight are the selfsame. But here you are, barefoot on a green lawn in June, realizing the difficult truth that happiness is not, in fact, photosynthetic. Oh, it's beautifully written. Although I suppose in the winter one might take objection to that and say, yes, it's maybe photosynthetic. Right. But where were you when you wrote that?
Oh, I think everybody has this experience where you go through this horrible, monotonous Groundhog's Day of a winter and you think, once the weather is nice, I'm not going to have a care in the world. But then when that happens, all your troubles are still follow you.
The act of having to think about and write about the weather, it had to force you to be more tuned in with the environment, your surroundings, what was happening than I would guess most of us are on a daily basis. Did it make you also observe things about New England that you hadn't or hadn't thought about before?
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I love this story about Emily Dickinson, that when she was younger, her father, who was a really imposing guy, taught her how to tell time with a clock. And she didn't get it. But she was too afraid to say that because her father was a little bit scary. And so she kept this secret to herself that she couldn't read a clock. And so until she was a in her late teens, she had to tell time using sunlight, you know, almost like a sundial method. And I think her poetry is filled with that kind of imagery. And it felt the same way for me. Once you really tune yourself into the weather and to the, you know, the way the shadows are cast and the way the sunlight feels and acts, it's like you're in a different, you're a little bit tuned into a different time and a different way of measuring the world. But that's, you know, this is the job description of a poet. We're like weather vanes, right? You need to be sensitive to these unseen forces.
Well, Will Dowd's debut collection of essays is called Areas of Fog, and it is an absolute, from the perspective of a reader, it's an absolutely beautiful read. So thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
And I should say that Radio Boston is produced by a bunch of people who bring a lot of sunlight into my life, even on my most mercurial of days. Those folks are Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, Allison Bruzek. We had help today from Zoe Mitchell, Cassandra Sunt, and Brian Bouchard. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Agnes Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.